All right, well, we're still in Deuteronomy, but we're getting close to the end, and today we come to the Song of Moses in Deuteronomy 32. This is a long chapter, and I thought I would divide it up. Not sure the division is the best, but it seemed to be about all I could possibly hope to cover. So I'm going to read Deuteronomy, actually backing up to verse 30 of the preceding chapter. So 31, verse 30, and then I'll read through 32, 27. Probably only get through 25, but that'll give us some of the context. So Deuteronomy, beginning at 31:30. Then Moses spoke in the hearing of all the assembly of Israel the words of this song until they were ended. Give ear, O heavens, and I will speak, and hear, O earth, the words of my mouth, that my teaching drop as the rain, my speech distill as the dew, as raindrops on the tender herb and as showers on the grass. For I proclaim the name of the Lord. Ascribe greatness to our God. He is the rock. His work is perfect. For all his ways are justice, a God of truth and without injustice. Righteous and upright is he. They have corrupted themselves. They are not his children because of their blemish, a perverse and crooked generation. Do you thus deal with the Lord, O foolish and unwise people? Is he not your father who bought you? Has he not made you and established you? Remember the days of old. Consider the years of many generations. Ask your father and he will show you, your elders and they will tell you, when the Most High divided their inheritance to the nations, when he separated the sons of Adam, he set the boundaries of the peoples according to the number of the children of Israel. For the Lord's portion is his people. Jacob is the place of his inheritance. He found him in a desert land and in the wasteland, a howling wilderness. He encircled him. He instructed him. He kept him as the apple of his eye, as an eagle stirs up its nest, hovers over its young, spreading out its wings, taking them up, carrying them on its wings. So the Lord alone led him, and there was no foreign god with him. He made him ride in the heights of the earth, that he might eat the produce of the fields. He made him draw honey from the rock, and oil from the flinty rock, curds from the cattle, and milk of the flock, with fat of lambs and rams of the breed of Bashan and goats, with the choicest wheat. And you drank wine, the blood of the grapes. But Jeshurun grew fat and kicked. You grew fat, you grew thick. You are obese. Then he forsook God who made him and scornfully esteemed the rock of his salvation. They provoked him to jealousy with foreign gods. With abominations they provoked him to anger. They sacrificed to demons, not to God, to gods they did not know, to new gods, new arrivals that your fathers did not fear. Of the rock who begot you, you are unmindful and have forgotten the God who fathered you. When the Lord saw it, he spurned them because of the propagation of his sons and daughters. And he said, I will hide my face from them. I will see what their end will be, for they are a perverse generation, children in whom is no faith. They have provoked me to jealousy by what is not God. They have moved me to anger by their foolish idols. But I will provoke them to jealousy by those who are not a nation. I will move them to anger by a foolish nation. For a fire is kindled in my anger, and shall burn to the lowest hell. It shall consume the earth with her increase, and set on fire the foundations of the mountains. I will heap disasters on them. I will spend my arrows on them. They shall be wasted with hunger, devoured by pestilence and bitter destruction. I will also send against them the teeth of beasts, or the poison of serpents of the dust. The sword shall destroy outside. There shall be terror within for the young man and virgin, the nursing child with the man of gray hairs. I would have said, I will dash them in pieces. I will make the memory of them to cease from among men, had I not feared the wrath of the enemy, lest their adversaries should misunderstand, lest they should say, our hand is high, and it is not the Lord who has done all this. We'll stop there. You remember from our last study that we're in the section of Deuteronomy which concludes the book after the renewal of the covenant. There's a section in which Moses gives his last words, and we emphasized the last time we studied this how important it is to hear the last words of a significant person. And in particular, in the last chapter, the last part of the last chapter, Moses emphasizes that he's leaving behind as his legacy, as a way of protecting the people he loved and cared for, two witnesses. They're really not his production, they're God's production, but he is concerned for them and for this witness. The first witness we saw last time was the law. The book of the law was to be given to them and put in their beside the Ark of the Covenant. And the second witness was the song, which is, of course, what we're studying today and, Lord willing, next week as well. So these were intended to be a way of preserving the work of Moses, as well as a way of God's preserving a testimony for himself in the dark days to come. And God does talk about the dark days to come when he addresses Moses in the middle of chapter 31. So that's where we are, the Song of Moses. It's actually a very important song from many points of view. If you look at the board, you'll see lots of references to the Old Testament and especially to the New Testament. And these are many, just a sample of the many allusions or direct quotations from the psalm, actually from the part of the psalm that I read. There's more to come next week in the Old and New Testaments. The psalm, the Song of Moses is frequently referred back to for many important references in the Old and New Testaments. And we'll see some of those, Lord willing. Not only is it important from that point of view, it's also a very striking and beautiful piece of poetry. So just viewed as literature, it's a very impressive piece. But from the point of view of how it fits in the book of Deuteronomy and the rest of the Old and New Testaments, it's important because it fits in with this covenant structure that we've been talking about. It is really has the form of what's often called a covenant lawsuit. So you may be familiar with that idea from some of the minor prophets who really come to the people and as if they're prosecuting attorneys and say, this is what the Lord has against you because you have violated the covenant. So in that sense, the song is a witness against them because it bears witness against their past sins, but also in a prophetic way against their future sins, and calls them to account. And it's that in that way that it's an explanation of the future sufferings of the nation, so that when the nation was in exile or in other periods of suffering and they asked, why are we going through these things, they would hum to themselves the Song of Moses, and the witness would be on their lips, as it says in the last chapter. And their very mouths would be the testimony, we're going through these things. This evil has come upon us because we have rebelled against God. Now, that much of it is clear and important, but unhappily, the way I've divided up the chapter leaves us with that impression, except maybe the little bit I read in verses 26 and 27. Because this song doesn't end with the covenant lawsuit and the chastising hand of God. It ends with the hope of restoration. And as we'll see, it even ends with the hope of the gathering in of the Gentiles. So the Song of Moses is not merely a witness about what God would do to a rebellious people, but of God's sovereign triumph over a rebellious people in changing their hearts and restoring them and in gathering in the nations. So it's, I'm sorry, again, I just didn't think I could get all of this song done in 1 week, but you should realize, you should either come back next week or you could just read the rest of the chapter, that it's really, in the end, a great encouragement. In the face of all of this rebellion and this ingratitude, God will triumph by bringing them to himself. Now, closer to home, one advantage of reading the book of the Song of Moses, I should say, at this point, is because it's a good review of the book of Deuteronomy. It really summarizes many of the themes of Deuteronomy. As we'll see in particular, it has the same historical survey as well as some of the things we've talked about in terms of the indictment against the people, which and the curses that we've been talking about. So it'll prepare you for the final exam, which we'll have at the end of the book. Everyone ready for that? Okay, so. No, don't just read the book of Deuteronomy. Look over your notes. I'll do all your homework and all the old exams, but this is just like a summary sheet to get you ready for the exam. Okay, glad you're laughing. But more seriously, it's useful for us as New Testament believers. I mean, we may wonder, what is this, all of this stuff about, you know, rebelling against the God who brought them out of Egypt? What does that have to do with us? Well, I would say briefly two or three things. First of all, this is our history too, because as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 10, in fact, he quotes from this part of the Song of Moses at later on in that chapter. He says, you know, it was our fathers who passed through the sea. But not all the Corinthians were Jews. It wasn't as if it was their literal ancestors. It was part of their story because they had been grafted in, to change the metaphor, grafted into the people of God and the work of God's providence. So it's our story too. This is the way God worked in history to bring a people who would preserve the witness of the gospel for the coming of the Messiah. So it's an important part of history, an important part of our story that we should remember. But from another point of view, it's useful for us because it really shows us how the gospel came to the Gentiles. It is by this provoking God to jealousy, we'll see, that God provoked them to jealousy by another nation. And ultimately, that's by the gathering in of the Gentiles to believe. It's a very striking thing that this passage especially is used by the Apostle Paul to talk about God's grand plan in bringing in the Gentiles, and then in restoring the Jews also. And that's the point I hope to get to at the end, although if I keep reviewing, I'll never get there. So that's, I hope, at least enough encouragement and incentive for you to get through the first part of the Song of Moses, because it's really describing the way God prepared things so that the Gentiles would be gathered in, so that in turn the Jews would be restored to him. And there are other advantages as well. There are warnings to us because we too have received privileges, even greater privileges than they. And if we rebel against those privileges, how much more will God's hand be against us? So we'll try to bring up some of those things as we go along, but that's, wouldn't say as quick as I could do it, but that's some background, and I hope an incentive to study the song. So there are different sections, and people who analyze the song in terms of the covenant structure may divide things a little bit more in a more fine way, but I'm just going to go with I guess we'll call it five sections, maybe four sections altogether. So verses 1 through 6 we'll treat first, which deal with who God is, and that is in contrast with the unfaithfulness of Israel. So in these, in the structure of Deuteronomy, you have repeated statements about who God is and what he has done for them. And here that's treated in two sections. So let's first look at who God is and as a contrast with that, what Israel had been. So the very first couple of verses open with a way to get our attention. Give ear, O heavens, and I will speak. There's an additional witness of the heavens and the earth, which is not an uncommon thing. It was mentioned earlier in Deuteronomy and is mentioned elsewhere. This adds solemnity to it because all of creation is bearing witness to the words that are spoken. And the second verse is encouraging because it reminds us that this word, as well as all of the words of God, are intended for our good. This comparison we may be familiar with from Psalm 72, but the word, the teaching here is supposed to come as raindrops on the tender herb and showers on the grass. So the picture is that this teaching will be as a refreshment to the people, as encouragement for their sanctification. And that balances out maybe the aspect of the witness against them, which is true, but it's a witness against them for their good. And God's word does affect, it does bring about its intended purpose, sometimes leading to further judgment, but here the emphasis especially is on the refreshment of God's words. So with that as the background, we come to the main part of this section, which is, as it says in verse 3, I will proclaim the name of the Lord. Okay, so I'm sure you're familiar with this fact, that proclaiming the name of the Lord doesn't just mean, you know, saying his name is Jehovah or Yahweh or whatever. It's proclaiming the name of the Lord means proclaiming who God is. And that's clear enough from the passage, because after he says he will proclaim the name of the Lord, he goes on to describe the attributes or excellencies or however you want to describe them of God. And you can just read in verses, the last part of verse 3 and verse 4, what they are. The greatness of God, he is the rock, his work is perfect, his ways are justice, a God of truth and without injustice, righteous and upright. Now it's important to note that Moses is here not giving a sort of a systematic theology. You know, if you look at a systematic theology, you'll have a long section on the attributes of God. And some of them seem rather abstract and maybe difficult to grasp. Now, they're useful, but here Moses focuses on the attributes of God that are especially relevant to the song, which is the attributes of God emphasizing his faithfulness to the covenant. They rebel against the covenant, and that's what the song indicts them for. But here, God is not like that. God is true to his word. And that's clear, I think, from the words that are used here. I thought I would lean on Matthew Henry to help me summarize this. So God is the rock. That word rock, I'm not reading Matthew Henry yet. The word rock that's used in verse 4 of God is actually used several times in this chapter. And this is one of the cases where you can see how often the later parts of the scripture use that image. Psalms 18, for example, and many other psalms refer to God as a rock in terms of his being a refuge. So Matthew Henry says, God is the rock, for he is in himself immutable, immovable, and he is to all that seek him and fly to him an impenetrable shelter, and to all that trust in him an everlasting foundation. So Matthew Henry is just going to go through the words here that are used to describe God. His word is perfect. His work is perfect. His work of creation was so, all very good. His works of providence are so, or will be in due time. And when the mystery of God shall be finished, the perfection of his works will appear in the world. The best of men's works are imperfect. They have their flaws and defects, and are left unfinished. But as for God, his word is perfect. If he began, he will make an end. All his ways are judgment. The ends of his ways are all righteous, and he is wise in the choice of the means in order to those ends. Judgment signifies both prudence and justice. The ways of the Lord are right. He is a God of truth, whose word we may take and rely upon, for he cannot lie who is faithful to all his promises, nor shall his threatenings fall to the ground. He is without iniquity, one who never cheated any that trusted in him, never wronged any that appealed to his justice, nor ever was hard upon any that cast themselves upon his mercy. Just and upright is he. As he will not wrong any by punishing them more than they deserve, so he will not fail to recompense all those that serve him or suffer for him. He is indeed just and right, for he will effectually take care that none shall lose by him. So, thank you, Matthew Henry. You said it better than I could have in a briefer way. So you can see in what Matthew Henry said and just in the words here, the emphasis on the fact that God is completely trustworthy. Now, you know, when we see statements like God is righteous and upright, a God of truth, well, of course he is, we say. We know that about God. God is, this, you might say, the standard of right and wrong. So how could anyone say otherwise? Well, of course, people say otherwise all the time, right? When they grumble about God's providences, or even when the unbeliever, who may not even claim to believe in God, says that there can't be a God because of all the things that happen in the world. This is God's witness. My ways are right, no matter what men say against me. And in particular, the witness that the nation of Israel might give and complain against God is invalid, because God is just and true. And maybe to see that better, you can just read verses 5 and 6, which is the last part of this little section, the subsection we started on. That is, they have corrupted themselves. They are not his children because of their blemish, a perverse and crooked generation. So the fault is not in God. God is faithful to his word. He is a rock. But they have dealt falsely with him. And they're charged with this, really, what's in essence a violation of the fifth commandment. We don't think about rebellion against God that way, but verse 6, is he not your father who bought you? That is, it's dishonoring your father to rebel against the God who bought you, who redeemed you, the one who created them. So you see the contrast in verses 5 and 6 between who God is in the opening verses and who the people are. And this reference to a perverse and a crooked generation is actually taken up many times in the New Testament in terms of the Jews' response to Jesus. So several times Jesus refers to the generation he faced as a perverse and crooked generation. And now I should have written down the verses I gave out. I think I gave out Acts 2:40. There are other references up here, but Acts 2:40? Yes.
And as many other words, he bore witness and continued to exhort them, saying, save yourselves from this crooked generation.
Okay, so there's Peter saying, in effect, if Moses called you crooked for rebellion against God's dealings with you in the Old Testament, how, when the Son of God himself comes and you should reject him, how much more are you a perverse and crooked generation? Okay, did I give out Philippians 2:15 too? Colin, I didn't give that one to you? Okay. Okay, thanks. I should have written down which ones I gave. I had to make a selection, but there are other references. Philippians 2:15 is interesting in that way. The language is even closer to Deuteronomy 32. Okay, so there is the opening part of the psalm. This is the God who entered into covenant with them. This is the God who is faithful and who is the rock. But up front, there's the contrast between that God and people who are foolish and unwise, who have that ingratitude toward God, the one who was their father and who created them. Any comments or questions so far? You really are out of my... my neck doesn't turn that well. Okay. The next section then, verses 7 through 14, deals with the history of God's care for his people. And, okay, I mean, I was sort of kidding about the final exam, but I'm not kidding that this is a good review of the book of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy opens with this sort of historical prologue where he recounts God's dealings with them, and actually it's repeated elsewhere in the book. What's striking in verses, the opening part of 7 through 14, is how far back he goes. He says, remember the days of old, consider the years of many generations, ask your father. So this is, again, very beautiful poetry. He's asking them to think about what they learned at their father's knees or whatever. Think back to what you know. And actually what he does is go all the way back to Genesis 10 and 11, which is not a portion of the book of the Bible that we often think about, perhaps. This is the table of the nations. Remember in Genesis 10, after the flood, the nations are spread out, and they are, of course, the descendants of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And it says, this is where this group went, and this is where that group went. And what Moses is saying here in verse 8 is that was God's sovereign division among the nations. It wasn't some kind of happenstance that this nation went here and this nation went there. Again, okay, so we're Calvinists. We already knew that. But it says specifically something very striking. When the Lord, Most High, divided, I'm reading verse 8, their inheritance to the nations, when he separated the sons of Adam, he set the boundaries of the peoples according to the number of the children of Israel. That is, he's saying that God so ordained the distribution of the nations to prepare especially the land of Canaan for its future possession by the sons of Shem, and in particular the descendants of Abraham. Now, there are some fantastic and bizarre interpretations of, according to the number of the children of Israel. You really don't want me to talk about them. I'm not going to. And I don't actually know what they all are. But even going way back, people invented really weird interpretations. I think the basic point is exactly that God, when he was seeing how the earth should be repopulated, he had in mind one thing, which is the care for his own people. And that's a very striking thing. I did ask for Acts 17:26, is that right? Yes.
And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods in the boundaries of their dwelling place.
Okay, so there's Paul at Athens on Mars Hill, and he proclaims the same sort of thing, that is, that it was God's work in the time of Genesis 10 and 11 and the distribution of the nations. It was God's work to set the boundaries. Just as a footnote, it's rather quaint. If you read the older commentaries, they say this is why one nation shouldn't invade another. I'm glad we've got all those problems resolved in our day. Anyway. The special point here, which actually Paul isn't making in Acts 17, is that it's God's special care for his people that's in view. And that's brought out in verse 9 in a very striking way. The Lord's portion is his people. Jacob is the place of his inheritance. Now, that's got to be one of the most stunning statements in all of Scripture. And it's not unique. It's one thing for us to say that God is our inheritance, which is a very beautiful thing, and God makes us to be his inheritance. But it's another thing for God to say, I'm going to make my people my inheritance. And that's what is said here. So I'll lean on Matthew Henry again. All the world is his. He is owner and possessor of heaven and earth, but his church is his in a peculiar manner. He has a particular delight in it. It is the beloved of his soul. In it he walks, he dwells. It is his rest forever. He has a particular concern for it, keeps it as the apple of his eye. He has particular expectations from it, as a man has from his portion, has a much greater rent of honor, glory, and worship from that distinguished remnant than from all the world besides. That God should be his people's portion is easy to be accounted for he is their joy and felicity. But how they should be his portion, who neither needs them nor can be benefited by them, must be resolved into the wondrous condescensions of free grace. Even so, Father, because it seemed good in thy eyes, so to call and to account them. And here, again, this idea comes up, I think I gave these out, Titus 2:14 and 1 Peter 2:9. Okay, so Colin, if you could read the Titus and then Sam the 1 Peter. And I think I had you back up so you'd have a complete sentence. So start, yes. Yeah, okay.
For the grace of God has appeared, bringing salvation for all people, training us to renounce ungodliness and worldly possessions, and to live self-controlled, upright, and godly lives in the present age, waiting for our blessed hope, the appearing of the glory of our great God and Savior, Jesus Christ, who gave himself for us to redeem us from all lawlessness, and to purify for himself a people for his possession, who are zealous for good works.
Okay, so there at the end, a people for his possession, that's applied in the New Testament to the church. And that's exactly what Matthew Henry was doing, and he was right to do it. He has a precedent in Paul and in Peter. So Sam actually gave you a couple of verses, 9 and 10, I think.
But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy.
Okay, so there Peter is piling up some other terms from like in Exodus and elsewhere, but specifically the idea that we are his possession is exactly what the Song of Moses is talking about. And the mercy, no mercy thing comes from Hosea. Lord willing, we'll get back to that in a minute. So here's the election by God of a nation to be his own. He chooses them out to be his own through no merit of theirs. Deuteronomy emphasizes that. It's not because you were more populous, not because you were righteous, but God sovereignly chose the nation and blessed them and so ordered even the settling of the repopulated earth after the flood. With them in mind, that the land of Canaan would be prepared for them, prepared for destruction of the Canaanites, but still prepared for the people and a strategic place for the spread of the gospel later on. Okay, I'm never going to get through it at this pace. And then verses 10 through 14 show how that election was worked out in time, and in particular in the time of the Exodus and the wilderness. He found him in a desert land. There's the sovereignty of God rescuing a people who are in distress and caring for them. And you see words here of tender care. He kept him as the apple or pupil of his eye. Okay, so Psalm 17, there are other references like this to God's special care for his people. As an eagle stirs up its nest, so there's the image of the eagle caring for its young and providing for them. Again, something that occurs many times in the scriptures. I don't think I gave out any of those references. But Psalm 17:8, Zechariah 2:8 about the apple or pupil of the eye, and then some references from Exodus and Psalms about even Jesus himself uses the imagery of wanting to care for them as hen. Okay, so not quite as prestigious as an eagle, but caring for its young. So the picture there is that God's sovereign election is not a kind of a distant thing. It's not like a cold election, but it's a warm, caring embrace of the people. He tenderly protects them in the wilderness. He provides for them. And the emphasis in verse 12 is that this is God's work alone. There was no foreign god with him. That's, of course, going to come up later because they invented foreign gods. But it was God's sovereign care and his alone. And then verses 13 and 14 describe some of the richness of the provision of God. This probably has in mind not only what he provided them with in the wilderness. I mean, wilderness is not a place where you would think of having abundance, but he provided for them in a way that sustained them for 40 years. And it also anticipates the richness of the land they were about to enter. Remember, this is all delivered on the boundary of Canaan. And so the description of the curds from the cattle, milk from the flock, and so on, talk about the richness of God's provision for them. Riding on the heights of the earth is, in verse 13, is probably not a literal geographic reference. It's, I think if a sports team does well, you say they're riding high, right? I mean, it's the same sort of metaphor, probably. It's a provision of God to make them from the low place of suffering and servitude and desolation in the wilderness to ride in a high place. So the point of this is that they have every reason to be grateful to the God who chose them out and who cared for them. He blessed them richly. He cared for them tenderly. He loved them. And therefore, it would be if it weren't familiar to us, it should be shocking to us to read in verse 15 the word "but." That is, considering all of the care that God had given for them, all of the riches, how could we read anything other than, so they loved him and they served him? But this, as this verse 15 begins the, if you like, the indictment part of the covenant lawsuit. This is the way they broke the covenant. This is the way they sinned against him. And they're given a name which is used in irony, Jeshurun, which means righteous or upright. Okay, so the upright one fell, if you want to put it that way. The upright one, well, the metaphor is actually has to do with obesity. The upright, Jeshurun grew fat and kicked. You grew fat, you grew thick, you are obese. Okay, this is the imagery that with all that God provided for them, just look back a couple of verses above, they prospered, but in their prosperity they forgot God. This is what Deuteronomy chapter 8 warns against, and is in fact what happened when the people entered the promised land and were at ease. In their ease, they rebelled against God. And I thought I would maybe look at this. I hope this is an efficient way to do it, in sort of a thematic way. Who is the one they sinned against? Well, he is called in verse 15 their creator. They forsook the God who made them. He is in verse 15 the rock of their salvation. He is in verse 18 again the rock, and he is the one who begot them and who fathered them. Or I think some translations have mothered them. I mean, that is, it's giving birth as well as begetting. In any case, the picture is, again, of God as a father or a mother who cares for them, and this is the way they treat him, the one who made them, the one who provided for them. And then you can see the way the sin is described. It's described in verse 15 as forsaking God, or again in verse 15 as scornfully esteeming God, that is, scoffing against God. It's described later on as provoking God to jealousy and anger. And there the imagery is that of an unfaithful wife who provoked God to jealousy because she went to another lover. In this case, of course, it's to serving unknown gods. They were unmindful of God, it says in verse 18. And they forgot God. They didn't learn their history from their fathers. They forgot everything. Now, the sin is specifically said to be idolatry. And it's idolatry with respect to not some other long alternative God, but a God whom they did not know. That's emphasized here in verse 17. It's kind of a striking thing. They went out and tried to find a new God, forgetting the God who had cared for them even to the division of the peoples back in the time of Noah. So they rebelled against him and provoked him to anger. Now, let me just comment briefly about one aspect of this. It says in verse 17, they sacrificed to demons and not to God. Now, this is a very striking thing because it says, in effect, that all service of other gods is ultimately demon worship. It is Satan worship. So in that sense, Satan worship is much more prominent than just some ugly image that they're trying to put in the state capitol building. Demon worship is really the only alternative, in effect. Either you serve the true God, or you serve demons. Now, that's important because people would, in his day, Moses' day, perhaps say, well, we're going to serve the true God by means of these lesser gods. We get into Canaan, you know, we'll serve the God of the hills, but he's subservient to Jehovah, whatever excuse they came up with. Or maybe, you know, our gods don't represent anything in particular, they're just idols. But no, he says, that sort of worship is actually sacrificed to demons. And I think I gave this one out. Psalm 106, 36, and 37?
Yes. Psalm 106, 36, and 37. And there he maketh the hundred to 12, if they may prepare. Oops, that's 107. And they served their idols, which were a snare unto them. Yea, they sacrificed their sons and their daughters unto devils.
So there specifically, though, the sacrifice of their children, child sacrifice, was sacrificed to demons. This is a striking point, and yeah, I'm glad I skipped over it because I don't have enough time. But if you're interested, look at 1 Corinthians 10, 19 through 22. I didn't give that out, did I? I really should have written down which ones I gave out. There the Apostle Paul actually refers to a practice in Corinth where the people were participating in meals that were associated with sacrifices, but perhaps were not directly worship of gods. And they tended to think of them as indifferent things. And what Paul says is that you're really participating in the worship of demons by doing that. Because what the heathen are doing is sacrificing to demons. And he's drawing on this same reference in, especially in Deuteronomy 32:17. There's a similar sort of reference in Leviticus 17 also. So that's an interesting thing to think about. Calvin says, whatever names the world may invent for its gods, they are so many masks under which the devil hides himself for the deception of the simple. So this sets out very starkly that the religions of the world, all the false religions of the world, as they serve other gods, are really only serving the great adversary of God and his people, and are a deception in that way.
And that passage in Corinthians is pretty striking.
It is, and that was one of those things that got left on the cutting room floor. Sorry, I wanted to talk about it, but you have to read it this afternoon. It's really interesting to see the way Paul, earlier in the chapter, you already drew me in, Randy. So, early in the chapter, because he alludes to exactly the same history. He talks about God as the rock, the rock who followed them, actually. And it's really, there are a lot of allusions in at least in terms of thought in that chapter, to the Song of Moses, but then specifically to say this is not an indifferent thing, because you can't participate in the true God in communion as well as participate with idols in their sacrificial meals. Really interesting. But no, I'm not going to take the bait, Randy. We'll talk about it later.
Good.
Yeah, thanks. You really got me going there. Okay, the last part then of this is verses 19 through 25. The curses of the covenant. Okay, and this section is very similar to what we've seen more recently in Deuteronomy. Those rather terrifying chapters, which are generously called blessings and curses when, you know, the ratio is pretty high of curses to blessings. But that's exactly what's going on here. I'll try to be briefer because I really do want to tie in with the New Testament hope that's presented here. I'll just try to summarize it. The response of God to it is, in a sense, very restrained at first. He doesn't break out in wrath immediately against them. He's long-suffering. But he does refer to them again in verse 20 as a perverse generation. So there's that same reference we saw before. And he takes up again the jealousy to which they have provoked him. Now, this is describing God in terms of human passions, which is like describing God in terms of human body parts. God is not a man. He doesn't have arms and legs or wings of an eagle, nor does he have the passion of jealousy that men normally do. But it's a helpful imagery because God says, in verse 21, they provoked me to jealousy by what is not God. I will provoke them to jealousy by those who are not a nation. Now, in terms of the immediate history of the people, this worked out in Canaan when they were subjugated to the Canaanites. You know, how embarrassing is that? The Canaanites were these corrupt people they were supposed to conquer, and yet many times in the book of Judges, for example, they suffered under the hands of the Canaanites, who were no nation by any reckoning. Later on, of course, they suffered under the Assyrians, the northern kingdom especially, and the Babylonians, the southern kingdom. So in terms of the immediate historical reference, this has to do with the fact that God brought against them nations who were not God-fearing nations. They were no nations in terms of God's election and no people, but God brought them in what I guess we would call poetic justice against the people, because they had provoked him to jealousy by what is not God, so he would provoke them to jealousy by those who are not a nation. Okay, now I know you're going to say, well, Paul talks about that in Romans, and if we have enough time, we're going to see that too, but here the immediate reference is that historically. So verses 22 through 26 talk, or 25, which is all I'm going to claim to be covering, talk about how that worked out historically. And again, this is very severe language. It's similar to what we've seen elsewhere in Deuteronomy. The fire is kindled in my anger in verse 22. Disasters, the sorts of things we've talked about, hunger, verse 24, pestilence, attacking animals, serpents even, the sword, so warfare, and that it would touch all classes, the young man and virgin, the nursing child, the man with gray hairs, so outside and inside. This is inclusive language to indicate how destructive the judgment would be. Now, there's something of a transition in verse 26, because God says, in effect, I can't actually bring myself to do this, if you could let me put those words in God's mouth. And the rest of the chapter has a more positive tone overall. But as I said, I figured I had to stop somewhere. So I'm going to stop there in terms of Deuteronomy, in terms of the treatment of the curses that would come on them for their rebellion. But I'm going to compensate for that by talking about the New Testament fulfillment, because the provoking them to jealousy actually leads ultimately to their restoration. Okay? So, not letting... Did I call on everyone I gave a verse to? Okay, good. So, let's turn then to Romans chapter 10. This is one of the places, and I said there There are other places of direct quotation or allusion. One of the places where the Apostle Paul directly quotes from Deuteronomy and the Song of Moses, and it's really striking here. I'm having to skip over something. At the end of chapter 9, he quotes from Hosea, this, "I will call them my people who are not my people," tied in with that reference in 1 Peter. But I wanted to say that just because you can see how that comes up again in Romans 10, and specifically here we are in verse 19. So Paul, talking about the need for the preaching of the gospel and the way Israel rejected it, says, "But I say, did Israel not know? First Moses says, I will provoke you to jealousy by those who are not a nation. I will move you to anger by a foolish nation." So there he's quoting from the Song of Moses. And what he's saying in effect is, Israel should have known that the Gentiles would be gathered in, which is what Paul is talking about in verse 18, because they knew the Song of Moses. Okay, did they not know? Of course they knew, because God put this song on their lips so that they would know this would happen. But you shouldn't stop there. You have to keep reading in Romans 11 and pick up the reading in Romans 11 in verse 11. So Paul continues with this idea of jealousy. I know I'm skipping over, but he picks it up in Romans 11:11. "I say then, have they," the Jews, "stumbled that they should fall? Certainly not, but through their fall, to provoke them to jealousy, salvation has come to the Gentiles." So there Paul is saying that it's in the historical work of God that the nation would reject the Messiah and the Gentiles would be gathered in. It's in that the provoking of them to jealousy is occurring. And he says, if their fall is riches for the world and their failure riches for the Gentiles, how much more their fullness? For I speak to you Gentiles, inasmuch as I am an apostle to the Gentiles to magnify my ministry, if by any means I may provoke to jealousy those who are my flesh and save some of them. For if their being cast away is the reconciling of the world, what will their acceptance be but life from the dead? And if the first root is holy, the lump is also holy. And if the root is holy, so are the branches. So what Paul is saying here is that the gospel was rejected by the Jews, but he didn't leave them at that. And what looks at first glance in the Song of Moses like a curse coming on them, that he would provoke them to jealousy by another nation, is actually, in the providence of God, the gathering in of the Gentiles, and is intended to provoke them to jealousy so that they will come to faith. And that's what Paul is saying in Romans 11. We've studied the passage before. I guess I won't go through it again. But he is saying, in effect, that this provoking to jealousy is intended to be for the good of the Jews. Because when they see the Gentiles come in, they will realize what they themselves have lost, and they will be restored to him. So that's one indication that the Song of Moses is not only about the judgment of God, but it's a judgment which is intended ultimately to lead to restoration. And there is in that chapter a point I haven't emphasized, but I'll close with this. There is for us a warning in that. And Paul gives it later on in Romans, because he says, you shouldn't be proud, having received the gospel and believed, that you shouldn't be proud and boast against the Jews, because the same thing will happen to you. And so we should read the Song of Moses, read the high privileges the nation had and what came on them when they turned against them, and realize how much higher a privilege we have to have the gospel and the full revelation of the Messiah. And so if we turn against that, how much greater is the hand of God against us, which is the point that Paul makes in Romans 11 and the writers to the New Testament make also. So, Song of Moses, part one. Any questions or comments? Yes?
Could you read that quote from Calvin again?
Yeah, this is from his commentary. "Whatever names the world may invent for its gods, they are so many masks," like masks, "under which the devil hides himself for the deception of the simple."
Religions, or are they the idols of the heart
I hadn't thought about it in terms of the idols of the heart. The statements that are given, the direct quotations, are all about worshiping other gods. Invented gods of the nations. But I suppose that would be something worth meditating on. I bet Thomas Brooks, in all of his meditations on the way Satan and his devices come to us, would bring that up. That's an interesting idea. Other comments? Okay. Let's close in prayer.